This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Stamfords Travel Writers Festival, Tim Marshall.
Thank you very much. Hello. Thank you very much. That was a lovely introduction. Thank you. Lovely to see lots of cheerful, smiling faces, but I can fix that quite quickly. I know everybody else that's been speaking has been sort of beautifully gazing meaningfully at the sort of heights of Mount Everest double glazing or something, or herds of gazelle across the Serendipity Plains. I'm not really going to do all that sort of travel writing stuff. I'm more here to descend into pits of sadness at a difficult time as we travel this wonderful world. A difficult time we'll come out of, I'm reasonably confident, but a divided world that we're all going out there to see again this year, I'm afraid. And starting from basics, why we're dividing, there's a quiz. Name that film. There's a reason these two are so close to one another. And if you don't know each other, the person you're sitting next to, don't try this, because they have a social agreement about the amount of space between them. And all cultures have this. All cultures, some more than others. The British are pretty much okay, slightly further apart. The Italians will almost rub noses with you while they talk to you. You might have conversations like this with them. Scandinavians tend to wave at each other from a great distance. But we all have it. We all know we need our space. Voila. See? We need our space. Does anyone know who they are? Joshua and that other bloke, as they're known. Klitschko. Does anyone know that film? 2001. The Dawn of Man, the first third of the film, in which there's a competition for resources, and this is the point that I'm coming to about the amount of space and what's between it. A competition for resources. Proto-human has not got the capacity to share. Proto-human can't work out that there's enough. They fight for it. Now, we've seemed to have come a very long way since there, because we do have the capacity to understand about sharing, conflict, resolution, and all the rest of it. But when resources are scarce, I'm afraid we can go backwards a little bit, and I think we've gone backwards a little bit at the moment. I mean, the difference is there are actually enough resources, but we haven't worked out how to share them out equitably, and at the moment, we're going through this bumpy period. That's one of the first major walls to be built, Jericho, about 5,000 years ago. Now, about 12,000 years ago, we stopped being hunter-gatherers. And when you stop being a hunter-gatherer, everything that you love and is dear and important is stationary. And we started building walls about 12,000 years ago. And we've never stopped. We've never stopped in every generation. There are periods where there are fewer walls, but throughout history we keep coming back to this competition. The walls of Constantinople stood for 1,000 years and nobody breached them in that time. So they can work. It doesn't mean you have to like walls and division to accept they can work, because it's a bit of a platitude. Walls don't work. They can do. Again, they can work for one side in particular, the side that built them. This is the India-Bangladesh border. The Indians have fenced off the entirety of Bangladesh, all 3,000 and something kilometers of it. All 3,000 kilometers. Watchtowers, searchlights, army patrols, lasers, radar, they've got it. And this is happening all over the world, but all the oxygen gets sucked out of the debate because of the Trump wall and the Israel-Palestine wall, whereas in fact it's a global issue. And when we're concentrating on that, we're missing a bigger picture. 63 countries wall or fence themselves off. A third of all the countries in the world wall or fence themselves off from their neighbours. And yet, I'm told we're living in an era of openness, and we're certainly living in an era of globalization. There's no question about that. But that's trade. That's something different. I'm not sure it has brought us closer together. And some of the negative effects of globalization have actually pushed us apart. Hence, people are being elected left, right, and center with very strong views there is a wave of strong men, and they are all men. There's Modi, who built this in India, Trump, Duterte in the Philippines, known as Duterte Harry. There is Orban in Hungary, another great fence builder. On and on we go around the world. Parts of Malaysia. We'll give you some examples. But that is the one, that's the biggest one, and it's the one hardly anyone knows about. This is our border with the European, with Africa now. This is the Greece-Macedonia border. Greece also has a fence with Turkey. Bulgaria has a fence with Turkey. I'm trying to think of other ones. Hungary, great fence builders now, and absolutely refuse to participate in the openness that the European Union is supposed to be about. Slovenia also has fences. Austria has fences. If you've been through Calais recently, you'll see some pretty large fences and walls there. We've got them in our own country. Anyone know where that is? Yep, Belfast. You know, we are not immune from these divisions, and I'm afraid I have to mention the B word at this point, as Brexit shows us. And also, that's a very good example of why we're going to have to get it right. Because if we don't get it right, there's going to be more of this. Forgive me if anyone's offended, it's a derogatory word for Catholics, but other derogatory words for other people are available, and therein lies the problem. So we've got to get it right, and there's got to be less of that and more people of goodwill before those walls come down in Northern Ireland. The English cannot help themselves sometimes. Look at them. They're always at it, the English. And there's some great court cases. When you're a junior journalist, these are the ones to cover. Great court cases. As I said, it's global. We all know this one. It's a stunning, stunning wall. Before I'd been there, I understood the concept that the Chinese have of us and them. I mean, us and them is global, unfortunately. But it's more acute in some places than other. It doesn't get much more acute than in China. Us and them. And there it is, writ large in, it's not really concrete, but in stone and brick and mud. It's 13,000 miles long. So that's like building, because obviously it meanders. But also it's triple reinforced in parts. So 3,000 years ago, odd, it's the equivalent of building a wall from New York to San Francisco and back again, and then back again to San Francisco, and then back again to New York, and then a little bit extra, Maine or Connecticut or something. I mean, what an incredible feat of engineering, which costs a lot of lives. But it is the greatest symbol of us and them. On that side, they believed were barbarians, and on this side, civilized people, cultivated the crops, weren't nomadic. And the Chinese remain, I would argue, in the top tier of nationalistic, self-identifying people. About 90% of the Chinese are Han. So there's 1.4 billion in a very large area, but 90% of them are Han Chinese. And it's writ large in the map of China. You see where the Han originally came from and mostly live. Well, if you look at what they've done, they've put a barrier, a division, a wall of sorts. They took Manchuria, the top right, and Inner Mongolia, Xinjiang and Tibet. So there's this massive buffer zone between them and the outside world. There's jungle down here, and then the soft underbelly is the sea. Always has been, but they're trying to get around that now. So there's a clear division as well. The Chinese are now world leaders at another division, electronic, and this is coming very, very fast. Again, look at the map. You'll have heard of the Great Firewall of China, which divides China digitally from the rest of the world. And China's concept, well, the Communist Party's concept of the internet is digital sovereignty. The American version is global, that the internet is open around the world. The Chinese concept is of digital sovereignty. Each country will control its own internet. And that's a debate that is having, and it is. I'm worried that the Chinese version will win. But the Chinese do something else in this new age of division. There's another firewall around Xinjiang. And there's another firewall around Tibet. And there's another firewall around Qinghai. So that Xinjiang can't talk to Tibet, and Tibet can't talk to Tibet. Xinjiang, because they've got independence movements in both regions. And if you've got an independence movement, you don't want it linking up to another one, another part of China. Another thing they do is they limit the number of people that can be in a chat room. It's very, very clever, this. Let's say there's 10 of us. Okay, comrades, we are going to march to the village square tomorrow and overthrow the system. Well, there's 10 of us. So then the police are watching anyway, your internet cafe, so they'll just smash you off the streets. But if I had 400,000 people in my chat room, they've got a problem. So they are dividing the Chinese in order to keep them united. It's sort of Orwellian, almost. There's a whole other thing about social credit system where you get... This has already been rolled out. Let's say I start on zero. I crash my car, minus 15. I kick my dog and get caught, minus 25. At a certain level of social credit negativity, you go to the airport. I would like to buy a ticket from Shanghai to Beijing. Well, you can't. Your social credit isn't high enough. And it's already happened in China. People have been stopped from traveling because they are not decent citizens in the eyes of the Communist Party. So again, these ways of dividing people, you know, the book is about essentially walls and fences, but it goes off into these other areas. Well, this is the one that gets all the oxygen. There's the previous border, Utah, New Mexico, Arizona, California. They all used to be in Mexico, and they are increasingly Hispanic, and there is a core vote within the Trump vote, which doesn't like that, which is part of what sustains him. You see the gaps in the wall and fence such as it is. And I've been arguing, and you see it in the book, for more than 2 years, the wall will not be built. He hasn't got the money. I mean, you know, you've seen the news recently about the shutdown. But there's also the Rio Grande floodplain treaty between Mexico and the United States. You cannot build on the floodplain. There's a sovereign treaty between two countries. And he hasn't got the power to tear it up. So no money, a treaty, at least half the American population against it, more or less. I don't believe it will be built. And he's already changing his language into, well, when I said a wall, I meant extra money for the border police. You know, he's already, in journalism, we call it a reverse ferret. I don't know why, but he's doing a reverse ferret. Bless him. And this particular wall is one of the ones where people say they don't work. In this example, it's true. Neapolitano was quite right. Most of the illegal immigrants that make it through to the United States pass through the normal border crossings. They don't pass through the gaps in the fence. See, always a way through. Can I get an R? Ah, thank you. Again, the demographics, just to try and partially explain the Trump vote. I mean, the Trump vote is also because if you're a steel worker and you see that nobody makes steel in America anymore because globalization allows China to put cheap steel, you're not interested in all his very unpleasant personal statements. You're interested in the economy, stupid. And that's another way to explain his vote. So I don't think it's necessarily a racist vote, a Trump vote. 33% of Hispanics voted for him. Of Hispanic voters voted for him. But there is this core racist vote within it which looks at this demographics and thinks, I want to stop that stone dead. And again, that's partly why he gets the vote. There's some of the prototypes. I went through all 200 that were put forward, might have been to the Department of Homeland Security, and to my delight, one of these that got through to the last seven is designed by a man from Texas called Hadrian, which is gold dust. Absolute gold dust. Bless him. One of the ones that didn't get through, it was very like these, but he had a 100-foot deep trench each side of it filled with nuclear waste. Well, that was going to get through, wasn't it? Anyway, there's not going to be a wall. There's going to be sections of it, extra money. He can stand in front of one and say, you see? I'm winning. We'll see. This is sensitive. Most of us have got big hearts. Most people all over the world have. And so your heart goes out to the people on the move because I think most of us know if we were in some of the situations that some people are, we would do what they do. Up to a point. So you're watching news in America and your heart's going out And then you're also thinking how much and how many people and which people. And this is a good example of when you watch the news, how your emotions might change. Because this is how people got into Mexico. And do you want to come into Mexico? Desperate people do desperate things. I know I'm making no judgments, but you know, when you see this sort of stuff and you realize that people are watching the news every night, this is affecting voting patterns and the way we think. I'd like to introduce you to what I regard as Mexico's preeminent political philosopher, John Locke, you've heard of. He's up there with them. Adam Smith, John Stuart Mill. That guy who played midfield for Brazil, anyone? Socrates. It's true, he did. He played midfield for Brazil in the 1980s. Yeah, as you know. Yeah. He's up there with those guys.
Están aquí, miren, bañador, en la chancla. Todo peinado porque no me dio tiempo nada ponerme la chancla y el bañador. Voy a la playa, había subido la marea.
It's true. Satire is actually taking over, not taking over, it is rivaling the news for social commentary these days. It's quite amusing. More divisions and another film, anyone? Those of us of a certain generation. Hitchcock, anyone? The Birds, indeed. Only because Twitter is a cesspit. I love Twitter. I'm on Twitter. Those of us on Twitter think the whole world's on Twitter. It's not. 15% of the UK is on Twitter. It doesn't stop the news every night saying, there was a Twitter storm. So, but they do it anyway. It's a very unpleasant place at times, as well as being a very informative and amusing place. But those of you who are on Twitter are probably aware of the social discourse and the levels to which it descends. It's pretty unpleasant. As an aside, nothing to do with a book, a Twitter storm works like this. Somebody makes a joke, somebody gets offended by the joke, a newspaper realizes that someone's got offended, rings up someone who's got a vague sort of name in the media and says, would you like to comment on this, makes a story about it. Twitter then goes even more crazy about it, and then Andrew Marr interviews somebody on Sunday morning. Even though hardly anyone saw and cared. But it's a phenomenon of our times, and again, it's part of this new world which we're trying to get used to. Zuckerberg said this in 2011, and he repeated it in 2017. And then last year, he said, you know what? I got it wrong. I haven't brought the world together. I've helped to divide it into social media tribes. Now, he's being a little bit harsh on himself, because, you know, you can FaceTime your auntie in Australia or your cousin in Zaire or Zimbabwe. Great. But we have also really, really divided and are continuing to divide. And it's much easier now to retreat into your own tribe and your own echo chamber. And there's a lot of that going on. And I don't know which way around it is. Is the current uncertainties and divisions in society leading to that sort of division in social media? Or has social media, which has given voice to people that used to take all the time in the world to write a green ink letter and post it to somebody as hate mail? Well, now it's much easier. You just do that. I don't know which way around it is, but I certainly think social discourse is massively coarsened and is now fueling the divide. So always carry one of those. Very, very useful. And let's keep the level of debate slightly higher than that. I do believe that, again, the social media and then the pressures on news media are also driving political discourse down and dividing us at the very time when I think the centre ground needs to widen as opposed to shrink. Back to physical walls. This is a template for much of the rest of the world because it's one of the most high-tech walls there is. Saudi has fenced the entirety of its border with Iraq. And look at some of the kit. You can hear a pedestrian at 18 kilometres. Very similar to, actually, Hadrian's Wall. You have an advance party that spots the men in skirts. Forgive me if there's anybody Scottish here coming at you. You signal back. They signal each other. They signal back to the reinforcements. And the reinforcements triangulate ahead of the fence to where the threat's coming from. That's how Hadrian's Wall did it. It's exactly the same system. So although it's 21st century technology, the concepts are 2,000 years old. Kuwait also has fenced Iraq. UAE is fencing parts of Oman. Saudi is fencing parts of Oman and is fencing parts of Yemen. Turkey has built a 700-kilometre concrete wall and has walled the entirety of Syria at the top. The whole northern border is a big concrete wall. Jordan has fenced off Syria as well. Egypt, having fenced Gaza, is now walling it off. The Israelis have got a fence on the Sinai Desert, and they're triple reinforcing it. So many people are desperate to get into Israel. They are flocking up from sub-Saharan Africa, and the Israelis are now really putting in extras. That's the Israeli-Palestine fence on the West Bank. More than 90% of it is fence. And again, that's the one we got used to, but it sucks the oxygen of publicity out of what's happening around the world because it's such an emotive issue. There's the wall itself in Bethlehem. That's Banksy's hotel, the walled-off hotel. All 12 rooms face the wall. I mean, it's a deliberate statement. And I sometimes give talks to schools, sixth formers, and sometimes this is an issue. I mean, most people actually don't really care about it, but people who are into politics care about it, which is not most people, but those that are, I say, right, I've got Palestinian friends, and they explain to me, you take your life in your hands if you protest. It's split me from my family. I can't get to certain jobs I used to have. Olive groves were cut down to build it. You name it, it's terrible, it's horrible, and it's awful, and I agree. And then I speak to some of my Israeli friends, and they say, 5 years before it was built, 1,000 people died in suicide bombings coming out of the West Bank. 5 years after it was built, hardly any. Saved hundreds and hundreds of lives. Is it a good wall? Or is it a bad wall? Is it good to save lives? It's good to have the debate. Far from immune. If you speak German, that's Oh mein Gott from the Chancellor. Now, some of us are of a certain age, and we remember when it was all very simple, don't we? Them, Eastern Bloc, us. And then down came the Berlin Wall, and there was that brief time in 89, 1991, when, wow, we were one big European family. And the old divisions, the old maps began to surface again. Holy Roman Empire? You see, the core, take out Italy, the core of the European Union, which I think is the one that will survive intact in its current form, is pretty much the same shape as the Holy Roman Empire. And that's based on geography. Then you've got places like Poland, Slovakia, the Czech Republic, and Hungary. They're known as the Visegrad Group. And the Visegrad Group have all got authoritarian leaders. Orban was elected for the third time last year with a massive majority on an open platform of, I don't dislike immigration, I dislike immigrants. He actually said that. And he was elected with a bigger majority. Can you imagine that if our politics was as bad as that? AfD in Germany, 93 seats. Because the Chancellor said, willkommen, and a million people arrived. The result of that is 93 partially fascistic MPs in the German parliament. And this is being replicated right across Europe as these divisions grow. It's a conversation we all need to have. As I said, they were happier times, briefly. And I don't think we're going to get ever closer union when even within the nation states, these divisions are gathering pace. Scotland is not finished. We'll come back to it no matter what happens in Brexit. But if there is a Brexit, it'll be a matter of time before there is another referendum in Scotland, I believe. And all these places have got their own irredentist movements. This is the United Nations map of this century. Every red dot, orange dot, 17 people, either a refugee and or an economic migrant. Now, the point of this is that, look at the flow, is south to the north. If you look at Latin America, that's probably Colombia, and as that dies down, Venezuela starts to move. Central Africa, terrible position. Côte d'Ivoire there in Africa. Overwhelmingly, people are moving from the south to the north, south to the north, south to the north. And it is fueling divisions in the societies. There is an aberration you'll see in a couple of years as Ukraine, when the Russian-speaking Ukrainians flee for safety into Russia. But that's an aberration. Now, there's 1.2 billion Africans at the moment. By 2060, it's projected to be 2.4 billion, so an extra billion, more or less. And if the continent can't get its infrastructure right and its training and its roads and its training doctors and hospitals and schools and the economy, well, a proportion of that extra 1 billion are going to move. And I don't think we've seen a peak yet, so we better get used to and plan for and start building schools and hospitals and roads here while simultaneously helping there. Otherwise, what has happened in Europe in the past 2 years will only grow. And I think we'll see this spring in the European elections, the far right will probably be the largest bloc in the European Parliament. Of course, Africa has its own divisions. If you look at Morocco, Western Sahara, there's a massive sand berm there, hundreds of miles long, mined each side. Kenya has just finished fencing off Somalia, the whole of it. Zambia has fenced off Zimbabwe, and South Africa has also fenced off Zimbabwe. Another thing that's growing in divisions, gated communities. They are spreading like wildfire, and this is because of the increased division between those who are well off and those who are not well off, which in our own country, I think, is worse than it's been for about 30 years. Hence, again, some of the problems. And again, this is sort of political, forgive me, not geographical, but when you get that wealth disparity, you start getting those divisions, and then it bleeds into the politics. And if capitalism hasn't got a human face, it won't survive. Capitalism can only survive if it has a human face, and its human face is relatively ugly at the moment. So, is this a vision of the future? Could be. Depends if we get it right. Are we destined to always have walls? Well, back to the beginning, we have the capacity now to share. We have the technology to share. We're working on it. I think we've hit a bit of a dip, but we can come out of it. On the plus side, if that is a vision of Mars attacking, the upside of intergalactical warfare is that at that point, there'll only be us and them, because at that point, we're all going to come together. So bring it on Mars is one of the takeaways from this talk. The other one is to let you know that Trump's reaction to being humiliated over the shutdown is so severe that he's developed a Cornish accent.
We are so many bays. These people come up to me, they say, Donald Bay, you don't really mean you're going to build a wall, do you? And I say, absolutely we're going to build a wall on Tamar Bridge. They go, well, you don't really mean that. I was like, I'm going to start in June and start at Bute. We're going to build a wall. It's going to be a high wall. See the Tamar Bridge there? I mean, this is a bridge you're going to need £1.50 for. Okay, you ready? Who's going to pay for the wall?
Devon!
Oh?
Devon!
£100. £100. So I get a call from him at the Evening Herald yesterday, and they said, the Mayor of Plymouth said,
we will not, under any circumstances, pay for the wall.
They said to me,
what is your comment?
I said, the wall just got £10 dearer. Build that wall. 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 Build that wall.
Build a wall. Build a wall. Build a wall. Build a wall.
Yeah, as I said, it's not exactly uplifting stuff, but I think it's where we are, but I am a great optimist in humanity, so I don't think it's where we're going to finish. I'll finish there, except if you have any questions, in which case I'll ramble on for another 10 minutes. Thank you. And there's Speedy Gonzalez there at the back. Thank you. Yes, sir. Hey, hello.
Thanks for a great talk. You obviously talk a lot about nation states walling themselves off behind borders. I was curious you didn't mention some of the flows that are increasingly global around, say, capital and climate. I missed the very start, so I don't know if you mentioned it then. Firstly, the way that many of the nations that are seeing outflows of migrants have a lot of resources funneled away from their treasuries through Western banks and tax evasion schemes, and then climate change contributing to temperature increases and make those places uninhabitable. So on those kind of two things of tax evasion and climate change, what do you think we might see happening in Western nations to address some of these root causes of extreme movement?
Well, climate change, a work in progress. I'm hoping artificial intelligence will work out how to desalinate water and other things. As for the flow of capital, that's flowing very nicely, thank you very much. But I don't, that does not in any way diminish people's sense of identity and the nation state and their tribe. If that flow of capital, they think, isn't helping them. And at the moment, we think that flow of capital isn't helping enough of us. And so there is a backlash. We're going to, as I said, I think we need to redistribute far more of the wealth from where most of the money is to where most of the people are. And if we don't, many of the people are going to move to where the money is. And I don't think that's healthy for either region. So, I'm not an economist. I don't have those answers. I just know in the big picture, if we don't do it, things will get worse. We have to have a more equitable society. There is one more thing, and that is about AI, which I didn't really get into. Artificial intelligence, if the experts are right, are going to do away with 50% of the jobs within 30 years. Now, if that's true, and if the other modelling of mass movement of peoples is also true, the mass movement of people, often blue-collar, are going to be arriving in the industrialised world at exactly the same time that half the jobs are going to disappear. So, again, these are conversations that we've got to have now. He only went there because it was closer. Yes, sir. Hello.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. I was wondering to what extent you think this is a Western phenomenon. I thought there's a lot of nationalist politicians in the West. We've got the US, we've got Brazil, we've got this country as well with the Brexit vote. Is that a case of disillusionment with politicians and Western agendas and democracy in the West?
No, it's not Western.
Or do you think it's actually going to be a global thing? I know you've mentioned China.
It already is. It's already global. Duterte in the Philippines is an example. Modi in India is an example. The fact that Bangladesh is fencing off large sections of Myanmar, Burma, is part of the phenomenon. The fact that Mexico deports more Central Americans every year than the United States does is all part of this phenomenon. Bolsonaro's election in Brazil, strongman part of this phenomenon. I mean, if you put a map of the world up, I can point you to every region that it is happening. But because Trump's wall gets all the attention, we're losing sight that this is actually happening everywhere. He's just one guy. But the other point you made about disillusionment with our politicians is correct. And as I said, that for me is because of the wealth disparities which have grown up. And capitalism at the moment does not appear to have a particularly attractive face. It's become harder than it was. And I'm not saying that moving to other models is necessarily the answer, but I do think people will be looking for other answers. And I think there's not just a lack of faith somewhat in capitalism. If you've got 35% youth unemployment in Spain and Greece, who are in the EU and thinking, is the EU really so great? But also about democracy. People are not quite as enamoured of it in many parts of the world as they used to be. And the last bit of that is that China has lifted 400 million people out of poverty via a dictatorship, whereas the argument used to be only democratic countries can produce vibrant economies that can lift people out of poverty, and that's no longer true. So it's the democracies now have got an extra problem. When you go to countries and say, look, we think because of X, Y, and Z, you should try these models, you're going to say, why? That model works as well. We don't have to bother with all that democracy stuff. So again, there's a bit of a crisis that we're going through. But I am an optimist. Yes, sir.
Thanks. Hello. Sort of two quick questions. One is, so many of the walls you talk about are contentious. I just wonder, are you...
What, sorry?
Contentious.
Oh, yeah. Well, every wall is out of thought.
Well, that was the question. Is any wall... Are you aware of any wall that is unambiguously agreed to be a good thing? And my second question is about the walls itself. Do you have any favourite walls, whether aesthetically or architecturally or engineering-wise or just for any other reason?
I can't think of a single wall that is not contentious. I mean, look at your back garden. I mean, look at all the fence disputes. In fact, that's another thing. If anybody thinks that walls and fences are irredeemably wrong in all cases, well, go home this afternoon and knock on your neighbour's door and say, I've had an idea. And they'll tell you to sling your hook because you like your fence and you like your divisions. We all do. Except a few people who live in communes. And they tend not to get on with each other either. But that's an aside. So I don't believe you can have one that isn't contentious because it's put there for a reason. I mean, you can agree we need it sometimes. And in Belfast at the moment, you knock on the doors of the people each side of it, nearly all of them want that wall to remain where it is. But they don't like it. And they don't like the fact that it's necessary. But they agree it is necessary. But if you look at... Brazil is now thinking about fencing parts of Venezuela. Well, that's not going to please the Venezuelans trying to escape Maduro. The last question about my favourite wall. It's not much of a favourite as a... when I first saw the Great Wall of China, it was sort of one of those... Whoa! I mean, I remember when I first saw Michelangelo's David in Florence, probably. I mean, you go around the corner and, whoa, there it is, and it's a sort of heart-stopping moment. It was like that when I first... Just because of its... magnitude, majesty, how ancient it is, the crenellations, the style. I mean, it's just one of the world's great sights. And it fair took my breath away.
Yeah, just a very quick one. I thought of a wall that it wasn't contentious, and that was obviously Pink Floyd's.
Florence?
Pink Floyd's. Pink Floyd the wall.
Yes, it was. It was rubbish. That a wall that wasn't contentious. Pink Floyd's the wall. I would refer you to the lyrics, we don't need no education. What a load of rubbish. Sorry.
The Lebanon had a 15-year civil war from 1975 to 1990. Was there ever a wall in Beirut dividing the communities?
I didn't hear the question. Could you...
The Lebanon had a civil war from 1975 to 1990. Was there ever a wall dividing the communities in Beirut?
Sorry, did you say Lebanon?
Yes.
During the Lebanese war, was there ever a wall in Beirut?
No. There were barricades, and you knew exactly which district you were going from because there was lots and lots of barricades in this district, say a Sunni district, and then or a Christian, and then you would cross and you would suddenly see loads of green flags everywhere, and you know, I'm in Hezbollah country, Shia country now. But there was never an actual physical wall dividing through the city because the city was divided about seven ways anyway, with certainly three main factions. So no, not to my knowledge. Yes,
you've
sir.
You mentioned Duterte in the Philippines a couple of times. Could you tell us a little bit more about his walls?
No, I don't think there are any walls in Philippines. But, sorry, I mentioned Philippines because of Duterte, the president, who openly says he wants to shoot drug dealers in the back of the head without a trial. You can make an argument for that, but not if you want to be a democracy. And Philippines is supposed to be one. But you know, I mentioned Duterte as one of the wave of strongmen around the world that have been voted often, not always. Xi in China is another one, but he wasn't voted for. Well, not by very many people. So that was an example of the wave of strongmen that has just swept the globe. Yes, sir.
Tim, thank you very much for a very wide-ranging and entertaining talk on the subject of walls. In the light of what you've said, do you see any areas of the world or whatever where there are moves towards unity and cooperation which gives you cause for optimism?
Yeah. Any examples of cooperation many, every day, both at a personal level we see all around us. Some of the charities you see in here are emblematic of the way we all help each other all over the world, because most people are actually fundamentally decent. But it doesn't take very many people who aren't to make the rest of us frightened of each other. I mean, that was the lesson I learned in Bosnia, in the Bosnian War, and never forgot. The United Nations, that is a coming together. It's like a local village council, writ large. We come together to try to work out our problems through... I mean, it's inefficient and inept and corrupt and is riddled with politics. Nevertheless, if you didn't have one, you'd invent it. And things like UNHCR doing incredible work. And they are the world policemen to... So that's the best example. Other corporations, well, all the major charities. The European Union is an example of 28 tribes coming together after having fought each other for 2,000 years and saying, we're not going to do it anymore. I mean, it's essentially the French and the Germans. There's an analogy that they put their arms around each other so tightly they can't get an arm free to hit each other. That is the reason for the European Union. And that's a great example. Now, I'm not making a political point about the economics and philosophies of it, but it has created, for 70 years, the greatest space, geographic and political space, ever known in man, with the greatest amount of people for prosperity, openness, democracy, human rights, and a standard of living that we've never had before. I'm not making an effort for or against, because I think you can theoretically have that outside of it. But that is what it has achieved, and it's for all its faults, I think it is to be lauded for that. But not for many other things.
Thank you. You've made several references to strongmen building walls of one kind or another. Do you see there would be any hope if, notwithstanding our current Prime Minister, whether the world was ruled by women more rather than men?
I do believe women are better at consensual problem solving than men. I do believe that. However, not sure that Gandhi did such a brilliant... in India. I don't think the Israeli leader in the 73 war, Golda Meir, I mean, she was a hard, ruthless... I refer you to Mrs. Thatcher, whose problem-solving for the Falklands was to send the Armada down there. Not saying I have an argument with that, but it's only what a man would have done as well. Imelda Marcos, anyone? So I can give you a whole... Boudicca, I bet she was... So I'm not saying that because of the pressures of office... I mean, there's an old saying in America, American presidents come and go, but the interests remain. And that's a very good way of looking at nation-state policy, because the personalities are actually less important. They're important, but they're less. So, yes, I think women are intrinsically better at cooperating and problem-solving consensually and are less confrontational. Merkel's a reasonably good example of that. And I hope that, therefore, fewer of them, if they were to be in charge of the world, would succumb to the vanity and aggression that some of the male leaders do.
Can I ask, Tim, because you were talking about having to share resources out more equitably. Is there an excuse or is there an argument to be said for us sharing ourselves out where the resources are? I remember you showed us that fascinating map of people travelling that way. Should we be moving the other way to counter it? What responsibilities do we have?
Well, we tried that in the 19th century. No, obviously we would go out as friends this time. We do go out as friends this time. If you go to places like Lagos now, it's like at night, you might as well be in downtown Manhattan. You know, it's bright lights, big city, modern world, comms, everything. I don't think they need us. There are certain places that still do need expertise. Yeah, I mean, Saudi Arabia's oil industry would collapse without the Westerners, for example. I just think we need to do a lot more cooperation. But there's a problem with my theory, and the young gentleman I spoke to earlier about moving more of the money. Moving the money isn't the problem. It's what you spend it on and who decides. Because if it's our money and we move it, do we just say you have to spend it on XYZ? Because that's neocolonialism. If you don't say you've got to spend it on that and have transparency, 20% of it goes in someone's back pocket. Is that the price you pay? So, you know, I've got that big answer. It's not really an answer, it's a big idea. The details of it immediately get difficult. But I don't think we, en masse, need to go there. I mean, our population growth is steady and sometimes slightly beneath what it is needs to be self-sustaining, which is why we need immigration. Sub-Saharan Africa, it's just still rocketing as it is in many parts of the world, so they don't need any extra of us there. Let's end on a positive note. If you believe the world's ever going to hell in a handcart, you are simply the latest generation of every single generation that's ever lived, and it hasn't gone there yet, so why is it going there now? There you go. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.